Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another edition of Calibrating Your Compass, a Brew University podcast taking a deep dive look at the J.J. Taylor 7 Leadership Competencies. I'm your host, Jeff Weaver, and I am joined once again by Bob and Matt Briggs. Bob, Matt, welcome back for another edition of the podcast. Glad to have you with us.
Glad to be here, Jeff. Looking forward to the conversation.
Jeff, you're a great host. You make this easy.
A host is only as good as his guests, and that's what makes it great. So glad to have you guys along for the ride. We're going to be talking today about cultivating individual talents, a leadership competency that I think often flies under our radar as one of the lesser used, lesser discussed, and lesser focused on leadership competencies. And yet, really as important as any of them when it comes to developing a high-performing team and taking the pressure off of a manager and making your job easier. This is one of those things that is often pushed to the side or put on the back burner because the business gets in the way or a burning platform takes its place and we think, I just don't quite have enough time for this. But like any good investment, the time you spend in this is going to pay some of the biggest dividends of any of these. And while some of these competencies are certainly fundamental and have to be right, this is one I think that if you can make the time, if you can carve out the time, if you can be intentional as a leader to cultivate the individual talents of your team members, it's going to pay you back in spades because stronger, higher performing, more competent teams free up managers to continue to work on the business, continue to drive things forward, and take away a lot of the hassles and headaches and day-to-day nonsense that comes from just having to answer the questions and fix the problems and clean up the mess after the people you have around you. So this is one of those that is underrated in my opinion, but of course, my opinion is just the starting point. What I really want to hear from is Bob and Matt, and how did this get to the list? What were the original thoughts behind why we chose Cultivate Individual Talent? And what are some of the keys that a manager needs to know to make that successful?
Yeah, that was an interesting one, Jeff, because we, you know, as we debated what the competencies should be, coaching was kind of elevated to the surface because so many people don't see coaching as a priority, as a top priority. As you pointed out earlier, you know, people get wrapped around the axle on activities not related necessarily to helping their people get better. But what we were trying to accomplish is to help our leaders at J.J. Taylor understand that their primary job was to be a good coach for their people, to be able to develop them, train them, teach them, mentor them, help them get better, so that the organization could become more effective. And, you know, what the trap that most leaders fall into is that, you know, and when we talk about this stuff, it's so many times I've heard, you know, hey, Bob, I love all this coaching stuff. I want to be able to do it, but I don't have time. And my, you know, my response to that is, well, what are you doing? If you don't have time to coach your people to help them get better, you know, how are you spending your time? And so, you know, part of the reason for it becoming a competency is to put the kind of focus we need in the organization to build better people, to build stronger teams, to make sure that we're to be able to sustain the organization through good succession planning, that we've got a good strong bench of people that can assume greater responsibility. So there was at the end of the conversation, there was no doubt that developing talent, being good coaches was a critical part of what a leader needs to be able to do at J.J. Taylor to be successful.
Absolutely. Coaching your people is the difference between being a doer and being a leader, right? That is the extra thing we ask of people in leadership positions that makes it a leadership position. If it was just about doing a job, you would just be in the job. But when you become a manager, when you become someone who leads people, when people report to you, your job is now to make those people effective and coach them and develop them and make them the best they can. That is the core of it. And so to your point, Bob, I always say the same thing. I say it anytime managers tell me they don't have time for coaching, I say, well, what are you doing that's more important than your job? Because that's your job. Your job is to coach people. What are you doing that's more important than your job? Please tell me. I will help you get rid of it.
It's interesting that so few leaders understand that. You know, it's not something you do part time or when you have a problem. It's your job. That's what you do. That's what leaders do, is that they're good coaches and coaches and developers and mentors.
Well, and you just hit on, I think, the biggest pitfall in this, which is people tend to only address this when it becomes a burning platform, when there's a problem. People only think about coaching their team when their team is doing something wrong, and they don't understand the investment value of, if you coach early and often, you won't have those problems. So let's talk about some ways that leaders can be more intentional, make that time, and what are the things you have to do to turn coaching into a proactive investment instead of a reactionary firefight and problem solve situation?
Mm-hmm. Great question. I think, you know, the first step is kind of obvious, but it might be the most critical, and that's, who do you hire? Who have you surrounded yourself with? Are you hiring people that have good aptitude, that have potential, that want to learn, that want to grow, that want to be successful? And so it starts with talent. You can't win without talent. And so step one needs to be that every time you have an opportunity to fill a position on your team, you've got to be very selective and set very high standards, that you know, that people have the right attitude and the right aptitude. Not so much about experience. It's more about attitude and aptitude than experience. You know, J.J. Taylor knows everything there is to know about the business. You can teach people how to deliver beer, but if you don't have the right attitude and the right aptitude, you know, you're pushing the rope uphill, and it's very difficult to be successful. So step one is, you know, how good are you at identifying and hiring the right people, and then it's the coaching and the development and the training to help them be as good as they can be. And I would also add to that, getting people in the right job. You know, people have certain gifts to do certain things, and part of the job of a leader is to make sure that you're able to leverage their strengths, minimize their weaknesses, so that they can be as productive as they can possibly be.
Jim Cook, the CEO of Boston Beer, likes to say every hire should raise the team's average. Every person you bring on should raise the average of the team as a whole. And if you're not doing that with every hire, then why are you making that hire? Why are you putting yourself through the time, effort, money, and spend of getting somebody new on the team if they're not going to raise the average of the team? So if they're not, if you're not confident that they are better than at least half or more of the people you already have, they're not the right way to go. And I think that's a great, great point.
A leaders hire A people. Right. They know how critical that is. If you're a C leader, you're going to hire C and D's. If you're a D leader, you're going to hire D's and F's. So the understanding of how important it is to bring in the right talent is a critical part of leading well, and critical part of building a strong organization.
A great analogy, Jeff. Probably a lot of sports fans or football fans. J.J. Taylor, I'm sure, you know, every sports team that's a team, there's a roster, right? And the coaches know where their strengths and weaknesses are on that roster. They can look at each person up on their big board when they're going to the NFL draft, and they know, hey, we have a gap here, we have a gap here, we're really strong here, we have an all-star here. And so the same principles can apply as a leader with your team. Who's on your roster? And then identifying the strengths and weaknesses of each of those folks. And it's, we all have strengths and weaknesses. That's okay. But then when you have a holistic view of my team and you're going to hire to fill in some new positions or replace people, you can say, hey, when we lost this person, we lost this skill set, and this skill set. So we need to really make sure we close that gap when we hire this next person. Or, hey, we're expanding our team. We're really good at this right now, but we're not so good at this. And so even just having something as simple as a notebook or a spreadsheet that has my list of people on it and just a couple of notes on, hey, here's what they do really well, here's where they're strong, here's what they enjoy doing, and then here's where they're not so good at, and am I coaching and developing those people in those areas? But then looking at the team collectively and saying, hey, where are we best? Where do we have gaps? How are we continuing to coach those things and then fill in those gaps when we add to the team or move people around? So just like a coach or a general manager looks at his roster on a football or basketball team, we can take the same approach with our team that we're leading at J.J. Taylor.
It really takes a lot of understanding and thought then about, you know, who are these people? What are their strengths? What are their opportunities? What are my needs as a leader, as a company, as an organization in this role and on this team to be able to put all that together? And that's stuff that I'm not sure enough leaders spend time getting their hands around and really thinking about, you know, who are the players I have? What makes them good? Not just how are they performing? Not just is the beer getting out the door? Not just are the MBOs getting hit? But what makes this person a good sales rep or a good delivery driver or a good warehouse team member? And what can I look for when I go to hire the next one that will enhance that, complement that, or strengthen those types of attributes? You really do have to have a pretty good sense of self-awareness, of team awareness. You got to be pretty intentional about understanding those things if you want to be able to continue to cultivate that talent correctly.
Great point, Jeff. And you also have to be self-aware. You have to understand as a leader, you know, what are my strengths and weaknesses? And you have to be able to surround yourself with people that complement those weaknesses. For example, one of the glaring weaknesses that I have is that I am terrible at anything administrative. I mean, just a train wreck. I don't like it. I'm not good at it. To me, it's a waste of time. But thankfully, I've got people around me that are really good at that stuff. And I'll tell you, I couldn't be successful without it. And so you have to think about certainly the strengths and weaknesses of your team holistically, but you got to think about yourself too. And what do I need so that I can spend my time on the things that I really do well? And I've got people on my team that can do the things that I do very poorly, very well. And that is a critical part of building up, a strong organization.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, again, comes back to intentionality. Do you take the time to sit down and think about this? Are you taking the time to really evaluate and measure your team on a regular basis? If you don't have that built into your routine as a manager, if you're not taking the time to assess who you have and where they can get better and where they need help and where they're strong and where they can contribute more to the team, if you're not making an effort at that, then you're missing the foundation that's going to make the rest of this possible. I want to go back for a second and talk a little bit about the hiring stuff, because that's been a big topic for us recently. You know, we've been looking heavily at Pat Lencioni's, one of his latest books called The Ideal Team Player. And it really talks about, you know, what it does to bring the right person on. He uses a model that he calls humble, hungry, smart that we've been sort of weaving into our interviewing and our performance management stuff. But it really does get to what you were saying, Bob. I think the core of it is, are we hiring for skills or are we hiring for aptitude? And I think we've been for a long time focused, like many organizations are, too much on the skill set and not enough on getting people that are the right fit culturally, the right fit for the organization, and then worrying about what we can teach them later. Because to your point, we can teach them beer. Teaching people beer is actually not that hard. What we can't teach people to do is be first choice. We can instill it, we can reinforce it, we can demand it, we can hold people accountable to it. But if you don't have that first choice nature running through your veins, it's very hard to get that into someone that it's not there. I've been using a real estate metaphor and saying, you know, it's like buying a house. You know, if you buy a house that needs a lot of work, you can remodel a house quite a ways. You can take it down to the foundation and start over. It'll be expensive and it'll take a lot of time, but you can do it. What you can't do in real estate is change location, right? Location's everything. You got to get the location right. And then as much remodel or work as you need to or are willing to put in, you can go from there. Of course, we'd all love turnkey, but if you get the location wrong, you'll never fix that. And I think when we look at cultivating talents and making a new hire, that's the question for me is the real estate part of our equation is, are they first choice? If they don't have that in their veins, if it's not part of their soul, if it's not innate on some level, you can't fix that. You can teach them everything. You can build an entire house on a piece of property, but you got to get the right neighborhood first. And the right neighborhood for us is they've got to be first choice. They've got to be committed to doing things a certain way that is that first choice way.
And yeah, you guys probably have a lot of this in place, and it's been a while since I've seen or known any of it. But if you're listening to this as a leader and you're looking in the mirror at how you do interviewing and how you identify talent when you're adding people to the team or promoting people into roles if you're a leader of leaders, you know, are you asking yourself the question, hey, do I do this pretty well? Do I ask good questions? It's not just about the skill, but also about the behavior. And are they first choice? Do I ask good structured questions to not talk about hypotheticals, but hey, give me real examples and scenarios of when you've had to deal with an irate customer, or when you've lost a customer, how did you respond? Or when you got in a conflict with a team member, and how did you bridge that gap? And so look in that mirror and say, hey, what am I doing well? What am I not doing so well? And where can I get some resources and from the other JJ Taylor team members that could teach me how to do this a little bit better, to identify not just the skill sets, but the behavioral first choice targets that we need in our people when we bring them on board. Because it's way easier to keep someone out of your house, to use the house analogy again, keep someone out of your house, then deal with them when they're already in it and they're not a good fit and they're not first choice.
The absolute key to hiring, to good hiring, is hiring people that have the right attitude and the right aptitude. It's non-negotiable. You know, the reality is that distribution is not rocket science. You can teach people how to do that, but you can't teach attitude and aptitude. If you get the attitude and the aptitude right, they can be very successful in the beer business. And to your point, Jeff, around this whole first choice thing, what we're talking about there is that we want to hire people that are hardwired to serve. And there really are two types of people in this world. There are people that want to serve themselves, and there are people that want to serve someone else. And you have to bring people in that want to serve someone else. If you bring in somebody that's selfish and self-centered and it's all about me, they will fail. They'll create all kinds of problems for you. So that's part of the attitude and the aptitude. You've got to have a servant's heart to be successful in a customer-driven organization like JJ Taylor.
So I think we all agree that it's crucial to get this right at the hire. If you really want to make your life easy as a manager, you got to hire first choice people from the get go. But for those you know, that we already have, the ones who, as Matt likes to say, they're already in the house. What are some things that we as managers can be doing to make sure that we're cultivating their talents as well? Assuming they've got the attitude and the aptitude, assuming we did a good job at the hire, now it's time to, you know, continue that process of cultivating the talents of our team. What are some of the things that you think every manager should be doing and making sure they're focused on in order to get that accomplished?
Another great question. And really the key to that, the key to being a good coach, starts with relationship. You've got to have the right kind of relationship with your people to be effective as a coach. There has to be high trust. There has to be respect. There has to be encouragement. You have to believe in your people, and once your people are convinced that your objective is to help them be successful, they'll jump off a cliff for you. So coaching and developing talent has to start with being able to build good, close working relationships, high trust relationships with your people. Once you get there, Then the next step is it's observation of the work that they're doing, being able to identify opportunities for improvement in a positive way, and then establishing a clear set of goals and objectives on how to improve, and then being able to follow up on those things to help them improve over time. But if the relationship is not right, if the trust is not there, the coaching environment, it will be it just won't work in terms of really moving, helping people move forward, helping them improve in their, you know, in their current jobs. The other thing that's important, obviously, is to be able to sustain the organization. It's not just about developing them in their current job, but an understanding of what are their career aspirations. I mean, do they want to be the president of the company? Are they happy with where they are? Is it something in between? So you have to have those close relationships to really understand what people want to do. And so that somebody that wants to advance, that wants to be successful, you need to know that so that you can help prepare them for whatever that next job might be. But I can't stress enough the importance of the environment that you create on your team to facilitate a good coaching, learning environment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dave Ramsey likes to say, if you're going to slap someone upside the head, you better be close enough to have your arm around them. And I think that's a fun little way, but it gets right to the heart of what you're saying, Bob, is it starts with people have to believe that feedback and criticism is in their best interest. They have to understand that if I'm giving you coaching and feedback, it's because ultimately I'm here to see you do your best and I'm here to see you be successful. If they don't believe that, it'll never get through to them. It'll never make it to the ground. And so if you don't have that relationship with your team, step one, build that relationship with your team. Go back and listen to how you instill trust. Go back and relook at your early days great manager work and understand that the most important thing is having that trusting relationship. And then from there, it's, you know, to me, coaching is laying expectations and then inspecting the results of those expectations. If you really had to say it in the simplest way, it's make sure you've given clarity to what you expect and then actually do the follow-up. So let's, if we could talk a little bit about what are some things that help with that defining clarity? What are some suggestions you guys might have for a manager on how do I set expectations or goals that people can achieve and hit and understand and that will move the needle?
Well, I think the most important thing is to understand that coaching is not about finding or identifying what someone doesn't do well and work on those things. That's not the way to approach coaching. In fact, that can be discouraging and frustrating for people. So we like to use the term 7-to-1 ratio. And what that means is that we're looking to be able to encourage somebody to reinforce good behavior, good results, 7 times for every time we might criticize someone for or identify an opportunity where they need to improve. The best way to develop people is to reinforce good behavior, good performance. That's what encourages people. That's what drives engagement. But it also earns us the right to have those conversations where we identify, you know, those one or two things that they might need to improve. Got to be careful with that because, you know, again, going back to attitude and aptitude, you may have somebody may be not doing so well on something that they just don't have the aptitude to do it. They're just not good at it. They don't like to do it. So as a leader, you can't be afraid of moving job responsibilities around among a team to be able to leverage strengths and minimize weaknesses. If you think that you can build a strong team by working only on those things that people don't do well, you're not going to be successful as a coach. You know, all of us have certain strengths. We have gifts. We also have things that we're not very good at. And, you know, working on those things that we're not good at usually doesn't drive good results. Give you an example of that. I'm a terrible singer. I could take singing lessons from the best singing coach in the country, and I can work at it every day for the next year.
Bob, you're not that bad.
But guess what? At the end of the year, I would be a better singer, but I would also still be a lousy singer. And that's the way we need to think about coaching. We need to leverage strengths. We need to coach on the strengths. And as much as we possibly can, we need to be able to minimize those weaknesses so that people can spend most of their time or as much time as possible on the things that they love to do and that they do really well.
Yeah, as I always say, training and development can enhance talent. It can improve talent, but it can't create talent. And so it does, again, matter a lot that you get it at the buy. But I think it's also about once you have that talent, you do have to put time into it. And, you know, it's such a challenge. We as leaders and managers, you know, we're constantly in the firefight. We constantly feel like we have to react to things. And managers, I find, often are pretty quick and typically all right at correcting what they don't like, but they very much forget to reward what they want more of. And yet the reality is rewarding the things you want done more are actually going to yield bigger and better results over the long haul. And if we focused on recognizing and rewarding what we like in our employees and when they do things correct, we'll drive them to where we want them to be much faster than if we're constantly trying to keep them in the guardrails. And so as leaders and managers, I always try to encourage people, take the time to recognize the people who are doing things the way you want them done. Do it publicly, do it often. it will drive everyone there because everybody wants recognition. Everybody wants approval. Everybody wants to please the people that they report to. And if they know how to do it, they'll do it. But most leaders don't take the time to demonstrate to their team, this is how you make me happy, so that they can do that. They only ever take the time to say, you're making me upset. Let me bring you back in. And instead, if they would just take the time to go, this is what I'm looking for. This person right here, this team member, this week, they got it all right. This is who I want you all to be like. Watch as next week, two, three more of them step up to try and hit that mark because they are craving that type of approval as well. And if you're not giving your team a roadmap to where you want them to go, if all you're doing is giving them the boundaries of where they shouldn't be, they're going to keep bumping around inside those boundaries until they find the right spot. Just give them the map. Just draw the line to say, this is what I want, and this is how it happens.
And it seems silly, Jeff, but it can be such small things that make a huge deal, right? So last time we were talking about customer focus, and you talked about a story about Disney and you all and having eye contact and smiles when you walk in. So if you don't spend any time with your people in the building or out in the field to observe this, you can't do this. But say you go out in the field with some of your sales team and you observe someone, hey, maybe they're not doing much well, but gosh, when they walked into a Publix or whatever business, they were making excellent eye contact. They did it with a smile. They were looking for somebody to greet. And then you go back with the team and say, hey, Joe over here did a phenomenal job at 1, 2, 3 when he walked into the building and greeted the customer, made eye contact, smiled, and then the rest of that team is saying, when you make a big deal of that, they go, huh, did I walk in with my head down because I was rushed, I was busy, you know, I'm a merchandiser and I was behind schedule already for the day and I just was running all over the place. And then they start thinking, huh, maybe I didn't do that well. And so reinforcing and catching all the good things people are doing and doing that 7-to-1 ratio will start reinforcing the things that are important and can change the culture of the team, and especially when new people come on and or they're in new roles. So it's critical.
You know, for our listeners who have kids, coaching is much like raising children. And it goes back to the 7-to-1 ratio that I mentioned before. But the idea of being able to encourage right behavior is way more effective than being able to correct someone. So we just really need to make sure that we create a positive coaching environment where we're reinforcing the things that we want to see and being very careful about those things that we need to correct. We have to correct people for sure, but we've got to be able to have enough money in the bank, if you will, on the positive reinforcement to make sure that we keep up the energy, the engagement, and the opportunity and the desire to want to get better as an employee and as a leader.
And it really doesn't take much. Going back to what Matt said a minute ago that I think is another critical piece is you'd be amazed at how little it takes to motivate and encourage people if you just make that effort. When my wife got promoted to a supervisory position, she had 5 or 6 people underneath her, and yeah, she's in accounting, and so they've got their month-end process and files that they need to keep, you know, turning into her. And the team that she was taking over was relatively young. And she had taught them how to do it the right way, but they were always making mistakes. And so at first, it was a lot of her going to them and saying, you made a mistake here, you made a mistake there. And one day, as we're sitting and talking, she's like, why don't they ever come to me with these mistakes? I said, because every time you come to them, it's with a mistake. I said, try going to them with something positive and seeing if it can flip the script. So she bought a bag of Hershey's miniatures. And every time they turned in a file correctly, she would go back to their desk and put a piece of chocolate on their desk and say, that file you just sent in, that's what I want more of. And pretty soon, every file was coming in correct, not because they cared about the candy. They, you know, everybody likes a piece of chocolate sometimes, but because they were getting recognized and rewarded for doing it the right way. And what she found was that they were talking to each other going, yeah, I turned that one in and she loved it. And here's what she asked for, and sharing their knowledge. And they were more willing to share their knowledge and talk about what had happened because it was a positive experience, not a negative one. So one of the catch-22s of a negative feedback is when you tell an employee what they did wrong, that message isn't going to get to the rest of the team because the employee doesn't want to go to their peers and say, I did this wrong and I got scolded. But when you tell an employee what they did right, they are going to brag to everybody about what they got and how they were recognized because it was right. And it sets that model and it drives everybody towards that behavior because it gets shared. It gets talked about, unlike negative reinforcement or negative coaching, which oftentimes will not. And so here again is just, as a leader, it's so easy to say, I need to address the problems. But if you can flip that script and focus your attention on the positives more than the negatives, not ignoring the negatives, but, you know, to the 7-to-1, if you can be spending more of your time recognizing what you want than scolding what you didn't, your team will get where you want them so much faster because you're giving them a beacon. You're putting a flag in the ground and saying, this is where I want you all to be. And it's so much easier for us to run towards something than to just try to keep bouncing off the edges in search of what's right. So focusing on goals and recognition versus, you know, strictly having all your coaching and development time be about what's not working, I think is incredibly powerful, but it is one of those next level leadership things. It's something that young managers get wrong and experienced managers will hopefully eventually come around to and get right, that setting positive goals and talking about what's working way more effective than spending your time on what isn't working.
Great, great points, Jeff. And I would say that the essence of good coaching is to send regular, consistent messages to your people that you care about them. I care about your success. I care about your well-being. I care about your family. And if people believe that you care for them and that you believe in them, they'll jump off a cliff for you. They'll want to get better. To your point on the candy, you know, people want to be successful. They like recognition. They want to believe that, you know, hey, my boss has got my back even in tough times. And if you can convince your people of that, you know, it's so much more effective in terms of helping your people get better. And conversely, it doesn't matter how good a coach you might be. If you don't care about your people, if you can't convince them that you care, you can't move the needle. You're pushing the rope uphill.
100%. Couldn't agree with you more. Final thoughts on cultivating individual talents.
I guess for me, another observation, I guess. I learn a lot about leadership from great coaches. And you wonder sometimes why and I'm talking primarily about college kids, but why would a bunch of talented young kids put up with all the demands and the butt chewings and the abuse they put up from a good coach. But what people don't realize is that a good coach, yes, he's hard on these players. Yes, he expects more out of them than they can possibly deliver. But the good coaches love their players. And I don't mean like their players. I mean love their players. You know, a lot of people think Nick Saban's crazy. All they see is this little guy on the sideline running around yelling and screaming at everybody. But I follow him pretty closely because I learned some things from him. And I can tell you that his players are extremely loyal. And the reason that they're loyal is because they know that he loves them. He knows it's not just about, you know, helping them get to the NFL, but you know, he wants them to be successful as human beings. And so therefore, you know, yes, they're great players, but they play above their skill level because they know that their coach is behind them, is doing everything that he can to help them be successful as human beings. And that really is the essence of coaching. It's this idea of really caring about your people, about, you know, taking ownership of their success, of doing everything you possibly can to set them up for success. And that's really what it's all about.
The last thing I'd say, Jeff, really where these coaching opportunities come in, people think, oh, I got to have all these meetings, I got to spend time with people. Or they say, well, I'm too busy because I'm doing the work. And back to your point of, well, if you're too busy, what are you doing if you're not leading? And yes, I know people have things to do that does not allow them to have eyes on their people all the time, but it's little observations throughout the day, throughout the week that we have to be intentional about, that we document and take notes. We may not have time to go address it right now or talk to them or celebrate them right now, but have a little notebook. All the great leaders I know and work with or see and observe, they all carry around a little notebook or pad and they take notes. So maybe I see someone across the building or on a phone call or out in the field do something really well. I'm going to jot it down and then make sure later that day I'm going to highlight it, talk to them about it, or maybe it's an error that we need to talk about and discuss, but I'm going to document it. And then I'm going to follow up on it and provide that feedback. And then I think we've talked about it before in this series, but the people that report to us as leaders, we need to have frequent one-on-ones. Bob, I'm sure, has talked about it. I can't remember at, you know, at this point in the series, but it's great to remind again, are we having frequent one-on-ones? We're not saying two-hour meetings. We're talking about, you know, quick meetings every week on what are we doing? How can I help? And then the developmental cultivating talent meetings, those might be a little longer. Maybe they're monthly, but we're asking all these questions we've been talking about. We're spending time. We're reinforcing that trust. We're talking about their desires, goals, where they want to go. How can we help them get there? What are they doing well? How do we celebrate it? The things they're maybe struggling with. Well, let's go observe someone else that does that really well and look at that. But it's back to that cadence of putting it on the calendar, following through with it, and being consistent with it. We were talking about efficiency offline earlier. This is an area you have to be efficient in. You have to plan for it. You'll hear leaders say all the time, gosh, the last 3 months just got away from me. I haven't sat down and talked with this person. Well, it's probably because let's go look at your calendar. You didn't put a reminder down. You didn't put it on the calendar. You don't have a methodology to hold yourself accountable to it. So it's just really critical. It's the small interactions done frequently and consistently that give us those coaching opportunities to really model that eyes on, hands off, kind of observing and never hovering leadership where we can have our eyes on, identify some things, document it, so we can go back and follow up later to praise, encourage, or correct or steer. And then the last thing I'll say, you know, while we're recording this, Peyton Manning's in, being inducted to the Hall of Fame this week. And if you go watch A Football Life of Peyton Manning or any highlight videos about him behind the scenes at practice and training camp during games, yes, Peyton Manning was a player and a quarterback, but he probably spent 90% of his time outside of the game coaching and encouraging and teaching others on the team. And if you go watch his Football Life, every little thing, a wide receiver runs a route and makes a good cut, he stops the play and goes and yells and celebrates and jumps up and down and said, that's the cut I'm talking about. That's an excellent cut. Everybody watch this cut he made on that route. And the people that come into the organization go, wow, he just took 2 minutes and stopped a play to talk about a wide receiver making a cut. But guess what? Those other seven wide receivers on the team watched that cut and said, I need to duplicate that when I run that same route. So it's just about those small little interactions that we do consistently and hold ourselves accountable to invest that time and coach and encourage. And it's critical to our success as leaders.
Couldn't agree with you more. Couldn't agree with you more. This is one of those, like I said, it's underappreciated how important this one is. But you know, this is the job. This is the job. If you're a leader, the difference between leading and doing is getting it done through others, and cultivating their talents is at the heart of how they do that. You've got to hire for talent. You've got to develop that talent. You've got to set expectations, and you've got to call out what goes right more than you correct what goes wrong. And if you get those things, if you get this right, it will make your job as a leader exponentially better. This is going to give you the team that you don't have to spend your time babysitting, that you don't have to spend your time cleaning up after. This is how you free yourself up to pursue your own development and chase your own career goals more, because you've got a team in place that can handle it, because you've got people on the bench who are ready to step in for you, and it's going to give you the chance to move your own career forward as well. So this is one of those sneaky little competencies that tells me who are good leaders versus great leaders. Who are those next level leaders? Because next level leaders, they get this right. So if you really want to get to that next level of leadership, take the time to get this right. And I think these are some great ways that you can start tackling that. So Bob, Matt, thank you as always for this discussion. It's been great. I think we have given our team what they need to get out there and start developing and cultivating talents in a way that will work. And I appreciate your thoughts and insights on it. I'm looking forward to the next one.
Well, coaching is a big deal, and this has been a great conversation, and we look forward to the next one.
We'll see you next time, Jeff. Thanks again.
And thank you all for joining us. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Calibrating Your Compass, a Brew University podcast about the J.J. Taylor Leadership Competencies. We'll be back with our next one shortly, so stick around, and we'll talk to you then.